Hi, I'm Rochelle Jackson. Welcome to The Crime Couch. I'm an investigative journalist and true crime author, and I know who's who in the zoo, the crims, the cops, and the interesting individuals in between. So get comfy and join me each week on The Crime Couch for a rollicking, intriguing tale. It'll be one heck of a journey. This is the second part of a two-part Crime Couch podcast. Anne-Marie Presland is a person with an extraordinary story. She was the partner of Robert Bob Trimboli, a man nicknamed Australia's Most Wanted during the 1980s. Bob Trimboli was accused of being a crime boss and an all-powerful head of a mafia family dealing in drugs, tax evasion and murder. But Anne-Marie denies that he was ever involved in crime. She went on the run with Bob and lived overseas in exile and in fear with the man that she loved. Anne-Marie was also a talented singer who appeared on Bandstand and the Graham Kennedy program. She worked at Sydney's Phoenician Club. I'm sitting with Anne-Marie on the crime couch in her lounge room on a rather grey and fairly average Melbourne day. Hi Anne-Marie. Thanks very much for sitting on the crime couch with me today.
That's fine. Thank you.
Okay, so I know there's theories about why you and Bob left Australia in 1981. I know at one stage it was thought to be because the Stuart Royal Commission into Drug Trafficking was being formed. Why did you leave the country, Anne-Marie?
Because we were told that to leave the country because they had it out for Bob, and it'd be better just go on a holiday, take 6 months off, go on a holiday, and when you come back, all this will have died down. That's what the solicitor told us. Mm-hmm. So we took off and we went overseas. We went to Frank's sister's place. Then about 4 weeks later, we decided to come back to see how the land lies. So we went to Hong Kong. We came back to Hong Kong and we met a couple of friends of Bob's on the plane, and you know, we met at the hotel, and one of the friends said, "Listen, Bob, you know that business with the Nugenham Bank?" He said, "Yeah." He says, "You know," he said, "they came up to me on the plane. I was going to Dubai. They came up and they asked me if I wanted to invest and gave me a card." And he said, "And this is how they're getting their customers. On the first, in business class, or first class, on the planes going across to Dubai, because they said, oh, we can invest your money over there." And so, yeah, they had a bit of a thing going on with the Nugenham Bank.
Mm-hmm. So you and 11-year-old Melanie and Bob, yep, left Australia in May 1981.
Yep.
You were heading to Europe via America. Now, you literally were you were on the run. I mean, what was that like?
Didn't feel like anything to me. It was just taking a holiday.
So you didn't really see it as being on the run. Did you expect to return?
Yeah, we expected to return. That's why we came back to Hong Kong 3 weeks later to find out how the things were going. And we were told things weren't going too good over here. So we didn't come back. We went back to Italy again.
So the Australian media, they claimed that you were living the high life and that you had a fortune. Is that accurate?
I wish I knew where it was, because we certainly didn't have a fortune. We lived in a little villa in Spain as I said to you in the beginning, when we were over there, Frank used to bring money over to us. So we had no problems with getting money because it was a partnership. Bob used to get his share every 3 months of what Frank owed him. And this went on for a few years, so there was no problem in the beginning. And then Bob met people over there so we didn't live the high life. We grew our own vegetables. The only thing we really needed to get by was meat. And it's, if you know where to go in Italy or Spain, you can find anything cheap. I mean, you know, it's just the way how the way you live.
The media at one stage did nickname Bob Australia's most wanted man. What was his perception of that and yours?
Well, we just laughed about it. And, you know, they were really upset when Bob got away in Ireland because, and that was through a technicality, because they didn't get him extradited. So they really had it out for him because they couldn't extradite him from Ireland.
So did he deny that he was ever involved in crime to you?
Yeah. Well, he didn't have to deny it. We never even thought about crime because Bob was always busy working, doing proper jobs like any other person.
And how long did you stay overseas for? You know, there was quite a long period of time where you were overseas and you're in Italy. And what was that like?
6 years we spent overseas. We couldn't speak to our family. We were away from everybody. My father died in that time, and I came back to Melbourne on my own and left Melanie over there and Bob. And that was a bit horrendous that weekend because they were waiting for me when I got here, and I had to do a bit of a flip around and do a Mrs. Robinson on them, change my name, which was, I was getting kind of used to it.
Is that because you weren't allowed back into Australia?
No, I was allowed back into Australia because I had a British passport. I was born in England, so I didn't have any problem like that. But it was just that I didn't know. I wasn't prepared to accept what they were doing here in Melbourne with everything that was going on.
In October 1985, Bob was arrested in Ireland on suspicion of possessing a firearm. He was supposedly living under a false name and had been supplying weapons to the IRA. Is that right, Anne-Marie?
Well, that might have been a stick of salami that was in the suitcase.
You don't? No, it wasn't a weapon?
No weapons, no. What happened was Bob was being very ill, and he was in the Gresham Hospital because of the cancer. And he just come out. We got him out of hospital, and we were staying at one of the hotels. And it was the Gresham Hotel. And did I say that? He just got out of hospital.
Yeah.
And we were booked in the hotel for a week or so. And when he just wanted to say, look, we've got to go and get, Melanie was down on the West Coast, so we had to go and pick her up. She was going to school at Colmore Abbey. And Glenda was with us. Glenda turned up. She was staying there too, because she wanted to see her dad. And so we got a hire car that morning, the next morning, and Bob was very weak because he, as I said, he was quite sick. And we walked to the hire car company, which was around the corner, and things were a bit odd. There was people not kind of, when we got to the hire car company, the bloke was stalling. He said this car wasn't right and that car wasn't right. And there was some feeling of something not quite right about the whole situation. So we eventually get back to the hotel. They said they'd bring the hire car around. We get back to the hotel. I packed the suitcase, and I had a big long stick of salami that I bought, because you can't get it in Ireland unless you go to the, I went to an Italian restaurant and bought it, because Bob hadn't had any much to eat, and I want to get him something nice that he'd like. So I put that in the suitcase, and it was wrapped in alfoil. Never thought anything about it. So we're on the road driving out of town in this hire car, and the next thing, they're up ahead of us, there's a road, all the cars are stopping, and there's just going out of Dublin. I said, what the hell? Somebody from the IRA, must be an IRA suspect somewhere. So we get to the where the cars are, and the police are going along, and they said, can you get out of the car? And I said, my husband's not very well. Why do we have to get out of the car? And he said, oh, no, well, we're stopping the traffic here. And the next thing, there's bloody cars surrounding us. And Bob had to get out. And they went through the bags in the back, the suitcases. And I thought, oh, God, what's going on? Anyway, the police said, you've got to come with us. So they put us in the paddy wagon and took us down to the police station.
And he was arrested.
And he was arrested, yeah. And he was kept in this little jail. It was a little jail just outside of Dublin in the suburbs. And we, Glenda and I, it was actually late. It got dark. So we had to find a motel. And I said to the policeman, look, I don't know where I am. I haven't driven in 3 years. I hadn't driven for a long time at that stage. And I said, so you've got to tell me where we are because we've got to find somewhere to stay. So he pointed us. He said, oh, there's a motel down this way. So he showed us the way. And I had to remember to get back to the jail the next morning because I had to take Bob's clothes or whatever he needed in the jail because he was in there. So the next morning, Glenda was her usual panicky self, getting upset and everything. And I had to calm her down. And I said, Glenda, just wait here until if anyone comes to the door, don't answer it, lock it, and don't come outside. So I said, I'm just going down to take your dad his clothes and things. So that's what I did. So I got his stuff, went down to the jail, and it was 6 o'clock in the morning when I got down there, because I couldn't sleep anyway. The minute I got back to the motel, I rang up Porrick, a friend of ours in Ireland, and I rang May and I said, look, you've got to get a solicitor for us because we've got these big problems here. So they rang up the solicitor and the solicitor rang the barrister, and that's what happened there. And in the meantime, I got 6 o'clock, I went to tell Bob what had happened with the solicitor, and I'm waiting just inside the doorway, and I thought I saw a cameraman outside across the park. There's a park across the road. So I hid round the back of the door and sat down because the shutter wasn't open for business at that time at 6 o'clock in the morning. I had to wait for the girls to start work in the office. Mm. So the next thing, this bloke comes in the door with a long trench coat on, and he went up to the counter. And he said, oh, I believe you've got a Robert Trimboli. The girl answered it. And I was stepped behind the door. And he said, oh, I believe you've got a Robert Trimboli arrest here. And the girl said, don't know anybody by that name. There's no one by that name here. And he said, oh, well, that's what I heard. And she said, no, sorry. And she sort of was making funny, like I was watching her.
Hmm.
Anyway, the bloke turned around and he saw me sitting there and darted straight out the door. He went, bolted, he did. And I thought, oh, they're up to no good. And he was an Aussie. He was an Aussie journo, and I knew the way he spoke. Eventually at about 8 o'clock, they let me in to see Bob, and I told him what was going on. I said, I've got the solicitor. And he said, well, you know, just don't tell him anything.
Mm.
We'll wait and see what happens.
Mm.
So that's what we did. We just waited and waited it out.
And Bob left prison. He did. He got some time, and he left prison on February 1986. He hopped into the car of his lawyer, and at the time, I think it was the lawyer at the time, as I said, and he was followed by a chopper, which was hired by an Irish television station. Now, I think you're in the car. What on earth was that like?
Well, it was a bit of a shock to the system. We didn't know what we were going to be doing. We just had to try and lose them. So the barrister was with us, and he was a very good barrister. And he said, oh, I know the way to go. So he took us some way, and we got out of that. The chopper lost us. We lost him. So, yeah, it was a bit, you know, at the time it was crazy.
High drama.
Every day at that Mountjoy prison, whenever I went there, there was always drama, but Bob was lucky because someone sent a message inside, and I think it might have been the Australian for Federal Police, because they were really in a hotel somewhere down the road. They wanted to put the wind up everyone, so they said, you better tell him in there, you better be careful because the mafia are after him. And so
they told that to the journos?
Yeah, the journos, the police said that to the coppers in jail, that the mafia are after Bob, so you better keep a good eye out. And they were all laughing, those Irishmen, they just thought it was a crack up.
Well, you and Bob at one stage, you were going to go to Spain, but you didn't make it to Spain, did you? What actually happened, Annie?
We did end up in Spain. Yeah, we left and went to Spain after Bob got out of jail in Mountjoy Prison. Mm-hmm. But that was, we went in a little twin engine little plane, which I thought if we're going to, oh God, I don't know if we're going to end up dying here or not. Because we're up in the air, and as you go into Bilbao, there's these twin towers, like high-rise twin tower beacons. And Bob said to me, you know something? This is because you feel the current as you're going to come into land in Bilbao. He said, they're going to have an accident here somewhere along the line. He said, because they're dangerous, those bloody towers. 12 months later, there was a plane crash, ran into those towers in Bilbao, yeah. But at the time, you know, we come in and I thought we'd never going to get out of that plane. But we had to refuel. We had to go there to refuel to go to Malaga. That's what we did on that little twin-engine plane, Cessna.
So you made it to Spain, and then, unfortunately, what happened to Bob? He was aged 53.
Well, he passed away. Yeah, he passed away Alicante. I think it was Alicante Hospital. Mm. We had to drive there. Anyway, he got really sick. Craig arrived because I had to ring him and tell him.
That's his son?
Yeah. I said, you got to come. Craig did everything to get out of Australia. And I think he got in trouble when he got back over that. But he finally got there, and we had to take Bob to hospital. And I had to go home to get the x-rays because they wasn't sure what was happening to Bob. And by the time I got Bob back, Craig said Dad had had a massive heart attack, and they had him in intensive care. He was still alive, but he was in a bad way. So I'd brought Melanie back with me, and we were waiting in the hospital. We waited till 9 o'clock at night, and he passed, and we went in to see him. And it was a pretty horrendous time. And when Bob passed, then we went back home, had to make our way out of the place. Craig was on the phone ringing everybody. And then after a few days, we packed up and we had to drive to, we drove to Malaga. It's about a 5-6 hour drive. And we got to Malaga and got ready to come back to Australia, and the police were waiting for us on the tarmac when we got to Malaga.
How did this very significant incident impact on you? Because you certainly didn't expect Bob to pass at 53.
No, I didn't. Oh, well, we were told that he didn't have a long life. The doctors told in Ireland told us that. But he was lucky. He lasted longer than what they said. So we were half expecting. We didn't know. You take one day at a time when someone's ill. You just don't, you know, you can't say, make any plans or do anything. You just take it a day at a time. But the worst part is when I got back to Australia was, I think the worst and the hardest thing that hit me was when they put that photo on TV of Bob, actually when he was dead. And
he was in the morgue, wasn't he?
Yeah, I don't know how they got, They must have bribed someone, the journo who went in there, and they took a photo. They moved Bob's head, and they actually broke his neck when they moved him because rigor mortis had set in, and they moved his head to one side so they could get a photo. So they broke his neck. And the next thing, Craig told me that when the body arrived in Australia, they still left the black ink on his fingers from where they fingerprinted him. All that. I mean, why on earth would you do that?
It still upsets you now, doesn't it, talking about it?
Oh, yeah. It's the what do people want? Do they like all this gruesome stuff? I don't know. It's just wrong to me. The whole thing's wrong that you could do that after someone's passed away.
Do you still regard Bob as being the love of your life?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was my soulmate, you know. You only get one in your lifetime. And Bob was my soulmate, and I miss that every day. Every day I could think, oh, I wish Bob was here, or oh, Bob would have enjoyed that, but I don't think he'd enjoy this coronavirus, I'll tell you that.
None of us do.
But, yeah, it's sort of kind of a bit like that all the time.
How do you deal with that loss every day now? Because it's been some time, but...
30-odd years now, and it's still the same. I still have the same friends Bob and I had years ago, and, like, they're all getting old now, and we often say hello and how's things, and we all just take one day at a time, and you can't bring back, you can't change what's happened, and you can't bring everything back again, so you just get on with your life like everyone has to.
Well, thank you very much, Anne-Marie, for sitting with me today on the Crime Couch.
That's all right, Rochelle.
Thanks for joining me. I'm Rochelle Jackson, and I look forward to your company next time on the Crime Couch.